This podcast is for general information purposes only and is not advice. Outside of the United States, this episode is intended for investment professional use only, not for further distribution. Please listen to the end for complete information.
Sitting here today, we obviously we're in the chaotic world. and that's the one that's materialized. And it actually makes sense why it materialized, because this idea that fossil fuels would always be cheaper than renewables isn't holding true anymore.
Welcome to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. I'm your host, Jackie Fortner, a portfolio specialist at T. Rowe Price Associates here in Baltimore. This season, we're exploring the rapidly evolving global energy landscape, diving into what the future holds for investors, innovators, and policymakers alike. And just a reminder that outside of the U.S., this podcast is intended for investment professionals only. In today's episode, I'm joined by Maria Drew, T. Rowe Price's head of global sustainability. We'll be discussing the trends shaping the global energy transition, a topic that engages a wide range of stakeholders, from governments, corporations, and financial market participants to scientists, NGOs, and of course, the general public. The narrative around decarbonization has taken a negative turn in recent years, especially in the U.S. And with energy demand soaring and energy security now a top priority for many countries, what's the outlook for global energy transition? Welcome, Maria.
Thanks, Jackie. I'm delighted to be here.
So to start off, you know, decarbonization is fundamentally linked to energy markets. And globally, the energy sector can be a really powerful economic engine. And that can, of course, intersect with political interests as well. So it's not surprising, you know, over the course of time to see shifts in sentiment along this energy transition journey. But there are many contributing factors to the more negative narrative we've been seeing around energy transition in certain parts of the world. So maybe can we just start there? Like, what are some of the different dynamics driving this change?
I think the fundamental difference is that the dynamics around zero carbon energy sources has changed from an economics perspective. As now in most parts of the world, renewables are actually the lowest cost source of supply. Coupled with this is the prioritization of energy security that we're seeing across a lot of governments around the world, really for a variety of reasons. Some of it is just kind of that good old-fashioned classic geopolitical risk that we've seen for decades and decades. Europe post the Ukraine invasion is a really good example of this. And some of it's being driven by a totally new phenomenon, which is the AI race. China and the U.S. are really good examples here. This is a big change, as up until really recently, the driver for energy transition was policy. And I'd argue that that's actually no longer the case. So interesting, the view that I've just laid out for you is not really what you would glean from media headlines. There seems to be like a very desirable narrative out there to say energy transition is going to reverse course. Well, I do believe it's going to be extremely difficult and probably unlikely that the world decarbonizes in line with a 1.5 degree pathway. I disagree with the idea that energy transition is just going to reverse course. So my view is that it's probably actually going to accelerate from here, and that the energy mix is going to continue to skew towards zero carbon energy sources. And this view is primarily driven by the underlying economics around renewables, coupled with energy security driven political support. And so I guess, why is this narrative just so negative around energy transition? And I mean, I can't say for sure, but as you know, we've seen a huge political shift towards populism, not just in the U.S., but also across Europe and other parts of the world. And given the amount of technological disruption that's happening, it's not surprising that we're seeing this shift. In fact, if you look back historically at other technological revolutions, you'll find this is actually pretty textbook to see these types of changes. And over the long term, we see that technological revolutions tend to bring economic prosperity. And generally, they tend to bring a very prolonged period of prosperity. But in the short term, the new technologies displace established industries, and they also destroy a lot of jobs. And so the short term is not so great when you see these revolutions. I think right now we're sitting in the short term right now. And it's also quite interesting if you look back historically, whenever one of these big technological revolutions happens, the new jobs that are created tend to be in just totally different places. So if we look at, say, the age of autos and the rise of oil and mass production, the change there was that people started to live in the suburbs and new housing was needed out there, and all sorts of changing consumer demand patterns drove kind of different industries to evolve. But that's not necessarily something that somebody would have forecasted before, and that's probably what we're looking at now. Now, I bring this back to kind of the point I raised around populism, because I think there's kind of an element of nostalgia that goes with populist movements. And if you think about this from an energy perspective, nostalgia is going back to fossil fuels. So it's sort of like the default mode for people to go to. But it's not actually taking into account some of the changing dynamics that we're seeing around these zero carbon fuels today. So namely the economics and that energy security change.
No, that all makes sense. And it does seem as though there have been a lot of shifts, you know, along the way. I think one that, you know, has been front of mind, or at least certainly that's been in the front of the headlines, has been around sort of this political shift that you noted around populism, but also kind of coming with that has been an increased interest in energy security. And that's, you know, not only here in the U.S., but also we've seen that in Europe, as you kind of alluded to some of the geopolitical issues over there. So this kind of focus on energy security, you know, different places around the world, how does that impact the broader energy transition?
Yeah, so energy security is going to be one of those factors that has an influence in addition to economics. And it's probably going to have a really, really big influence over kind of the next 3 to 10 years. It's also an interesting one because energy security is one of those areas where governments have historically been much more willing to make really long-term strategic investments. So it's one of those things that can start kind of like moving the dial on things. And we think the way that this is going to show up is through increased investment in grid expansion, also grid reinforcement, battery storage, and probably also nuclear power. And some of these areas, like I would argue, maybe the grid expansion and the grid reinforcement are not kind of economically difficult decisions to make, but battery storage and nuclear are. Those are not kind of in the money technologies today. So that's really about thinking for the future and trying to build out a new system. And so I think that we'll probably start to see more of those decisions being made. But maybe it's worth kind of taking a step back and thinking about what exactly do we mean by energy security? Because it's a pretty broad term. So kind of simply put, energy security is defined as uninterrupted availability of energy at an affordable price. So very broad concept. It can relate to geopolitical, domestic, or any other type of supply risk. And it can refer to like a short-term horizon or a very long-term horizon. And when we look at the three big energy-consuming regions, so U.S., EU, China, we think that energy security is going to be a big factor in all three of them, but in really different ways. So both the EU and China have energy security concerns that relate to just obtaining access to energy resources. So both of these regions are importers of oil and gas, and they have this kind of inbuilt vulnerability. Also, Europe obviously has a very immediate threat as it's historically received a material amount of its energy from Russia. Now, the U.S. is very different because it's actually a net exporter of oil and gas. So instead, the U.S. energy security issues, you know, they're still there, even though they're an exporter, but they're focused around winning the AI race and the energy needs that are going to be required for winning the AI race. But I think what's also kind of interesting about this from the U.S. perspective is historically, whenever the U.S. has had security of supply issues, it's really been around obtaining oil and gas. This time it's different. It's about being able to supply electricity because that's what AI is demanding. And then China also brings in another interesting element in that it is also trying to win the AI race, and it's going to need more electricity supply as well.
So thanks, Maria. You know, really in-depth discussion around kind of what energy security means for all of these countries. And as part of that, you know, you did touch on concerns around affordability which certainly are very real. I mean, even with the build out of data centers in the mid-Atlantic of the U.S., you know, where I'm sitting today in the state of Maryland, who will shoulder the rising energy costs is a pretty fierce topic of debate. So maybe can we talk a little bit more about the energy trilemma? You know, we can talk in the context of Europe and the U.S., but both regions, you know, as we mentioned, are focused on energy security, but there's also you know, these other factors that come into play that have to be considered, and they're maybe taking different approaches.
Yeah. So the energy trilemma is a framework for balancing three conflicting objectives. So they'd be sustainability, security, and affordability. And the idea of it is that policymakers have to find a compromise between these three goals. And achieving one of them is always going to, you know, at least somewhat erode the other two. So they're just competing objectives. I think what's really interesting now is that the dynamics of renewables have changed, because it used to be that renewables only had support within the trilemma on that little point of sustainability. So you really needed policy to push them forward. But that's not the case anymore for most regions, because in most regions, they're actually at the bottom of the cost curve. And we talked a little bit about security in the last question, and I think the energy security coming in is another like really important touch point on that, because that's what's going to help to drive some of those factors that help balance renewables. So in terms of reinforcing the grid, growing more electrification, growing more battery storage, but also having more nuclear supply coming on down the road. And that's a very long-term strategic objective. But if we think about kind of the energy trilemma between the U.S. and Europe, it's a really interesting comparison, because both of those regions are having cost of living crises. You know, everybody's talking about high energy prices. I live here in the U.K., and on the Sunday morning talk shows recently, we've had these unbelievably well-informed discussions about power prices and exactly what drives higher power prices and how bills will change. As a former utilities analyst, I was really impressed at the level of conversation on it by politicians, which is not, you know, always the case. And I imagine that's happening in, you know, lots of different countries in the world. People really understand where those pressures are coming from. And I know the same discussions are happening in the U.S. In the U.S., natural gas is actually the cheapest source of supply. And there's also like a very different dynamic in the way that electricity markets are structured. That means that there's more of a regulated market, and you can kind of ease in price increases over time. And so that cost of living pressure kind of makes natural gas much more attractive in the cost scheme. We think renewables are actually probably still pretty attractive even after losing subsidies, because they're not a very expensive source of supply either, even though they're not quite as cheap as natural gas. But in Europe, it's a totally different story, because people understand that the thing that is spiking power prices right now is fossil fuels. And it has to do with the fact that Europe has a different type of market structure, in that the marginal price of electricity drives the price in Europe, mainly for, I'm simplifying, but, you know, mainly for the whole market. And as a result, people really understand high gas prices means really high power prices. And so they can see the advantage of renewables, because eventually that will help to kind of lower the bills, or at least not increase bills quite as much in the future. So here, you know, you see two different regions facing the exact same cost pressure, but the way that they address it is going to be different.
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, take on how the two different regions are handling the same issue. And actually, you know, you touched briefly on, you know, nuclear and the likelihood of that being part of the solution down the road. I mean, that's an energy source that's being reprioritized in the U.S. by the Trump administration. You know, they have stated a goal to quadruple U.S. nuclear energy capacity by 2050. And actually, that's something that you and I are going to be discussing at length later this season. But it does seem that, you know, even though you know, nuclear may be on the precipice of making a comeback. That's something that's going to take time. And as you mentioned, in the meanwhile, both regions are, you know, globally, really, we're going to have to find other ways to make a dent in covering this energy demand.
Yes, that'll be a great discussion. I think the nuclear story is fascinating. We see that China and Korea can bring on nuclear in a pretty cost-effective way, but the U.S. and Europe can't. And there have been some horror stories on the recent nuclear power plant builds in both the United States and the European Union and the U.K. The main reason for this is because the West just doesn't have a thriving nuclear industry. People hadn't been building nuclear power plants for a really long time. And in the U.S., you see that Trump is actually willing to make a really big strategic decision to support the renewal of the nuclear power industry. Europe's also had a little bit of a sea change, but they're not going as far as to like really try and support the industry the way the U.S. is. And I'd say the change in Europe is, it used to be that Europe was really split on the idea of nuclear power. And you had the French leading the pro-nuclear camp and the Germans leading the anti-nuclear camp. But over time, that anti-nuclear camp has really had a sea change. So the view on nuclear power has changed dramatically. And it's now viewed as a solution. Whereas, you know, probably if we looked at it even 5 years ago, it was a much more mixed view on the role that nuclear should play.
Well, and also, you know, we've kind of focused on sort of the U.S. and the EU, but, you know, certainly China is also one who has seen kind of the absolute cost of solar being cheaper and nuclear plants that can be built maybe more competitively than in the U.S. and the EU. So what, you know, what about China? If we kind of shift this discussion over there, you know, it's a country that's also shown it can electrify and maybe even, you know, at a faster rate than the U.S. and the EU. So how, you know, how are we going to see China taking a bigger role, you know, in this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, what's going on in China is really interesting. You know, China, I think, is oftentimes sort of overlooked the progress that they're making on changing their energy mix. And part of the reason why it's overlooked, just from like sort of a mainstream media perspective, is because the country has still been building coal plants, right? Because their overall energy demands have been so great, they just keep adding capacity. And it's not always been like so widely recognized how much zero carbon energy they've been bringing on, but also the shift that they're making to electrification. And so I think that China's going to be really interesting to watch. And I've covered China for a long time, lots of different markets around the world. And what I understand about the Chinese market is when they set a strategic priority in how they want to move the energy market, they're able to do it much more efficiently than other countries are.
You know, and certainly as part of that, you know, China is also, we can't forget, you know, a key player in the AI race. So they're going to need, kind of expanding on what you're talking about, you know, they're going to need a secure electricity supply to support those initiatives as well.
Yeah, no, great. I can't believe I didn't even mention AI in that answer, but obviously really, really crucial. And I think it's interesting, too, like if we look at the Chinese energy demand historically, you can put it into three basic phases. You had that industrialization period, which was really up until about 2010. And then you moved into this period of kind of, it's called chasing megawatts with the more renewables, more coal tagline associated with it. But I think that ended somewhere, you know, a bit after 2020. And now we're really seeing this shift to trying to build what they call a clean energy megasystem. And I think AI is going to have a big part within that as well.
Yeah, so you've highlighted a lot of kind of the really what seems like pretty structural trends in the global economy that are going to be supportive of sort of low and zero carbon infrastructure investments. So as we sort of back up and think about what this transition looks like over time, sometimes it seems like it's just either you're going to have this high emitting world or you're going to have this low emitting world, and it actually seems like there's kind of a path from one towards the other, and maybe it's not exactly a straight line. But how do we think about that shift really going from maybe these higher emitting fuels down to something that's, maybe either a balance or, really getting to that low emitting world in the future?
So I remember many years ago, I'm not even sure how long it was, it might even be 20 years ago, being in a meeting with Royal Dutch Shell, and they have a group that they've had in place, I think since the 1970s, that just looks at energy scenarios. They're independent from the operations of the company, and they really just look at what are the possible scenarios for energy demand in the future and take a really long-term view. And they always put out more than one scenario at a time. At this one, they had two of them. One was an orderly transition, and the other one was a more chaotic transition. I can't remember exactly what they called it at the time. But that chaotic one, to me, at that moment, I just couldn't understand how it could possibly materialize, because it was a view that you would have a renewables and coal world, as opposed to going from the highest emitting fuel of coal, transitioning towards natural gas, which is affordable but lower emitting, and then eventually going to renewables, which just felt much more sensible at that time. But now, sitting here today, we obviously we're in the chaotic world. and that's the one that's materialized. And it actually makes sense why it materialized, because this idea that fossil fuels would always be cheaper than renewables isn't holding true anymore. And so it's an interesting dynamic, because while I don't think that we're going to be in a coal renewables world where we're building a lot more coal, I think what you're seeing here is we're probably going to see some coal plants stay on stream longer than anticipated. And the U.S. might be the country where this is one of the biggest factors, because it's an area where you're looking at rising electricity prices and that being very problematic to cost of living. Solving that by building more natural gas plants and adding to the rate base probably doesn't make sense. You probably just want to keep that old coal plant that was supposed to shut down on for longer, and then you start bringing in some additional kind of cheaper sources of supply alongside that. And also in the U.S., maybe nuclear ends up being kind of that big change factor as we go down the road.
And, maybe even just backing up a little bit, in the first episode of this season, we looked at oil and gas, and that was primarily from, a U.S. perspective. So your global views here are really informative. And maybe, with the connection between kind of energy security and climate, making the case, potentially for renewables even stronger, how do we think about, some of the global leaders that are emerging in energy transition? Countries and companies are moving at different speeds, but there are a lot of these tailwinds to this theme, overall. So as we kind of step back and look at where this transition is going, how do you see that playing out, as we look around the globe?
I think what's interesting now is obviously we've mentioned the cost of renewables is just radically different than it's been before. The other aspect of renewables we haven't talked about is that they used to be just such a tiny sliver of supply that it just didn't matter. If you increased it by 100%, it just weren't big enough to matter. But that's changed. They're actually a decent little chunk of the market now. So these incremental adds are starting to make a difference. And so I think that that's an important factor to think about going forward. The other sort of big interesting catalyst right now, maybe to look at one region in particular. So if we look at Europe, since 1990, Europe has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by 37%. At least I think that was the number as of 2023. And so they've made a lot of progress in terms of decarbonization. Most of that has come from energy efficiency, but also working to make its electricity mix greener. So, you know, bringing more renewables into that electricity mix. If we look at Europe right now, or the EU, 47% of the electricity supply is from renewables, and another 24% is from nuclear. So pretty green from that perspective. But where they've made less progress is in the transport system and also in emissions from buildings. And there is a new piece of regulation that's coming into play in Europe that is right now somewhat controversial, and it's called ETS2. So that's Emission Trading Scheme 2. And what it's doing is basically adding more sectors into the emissions trading scheme, so namely road transport and also buildings. So it's meant to really push more EVs and more heat pumps to be used across the continent. And I think if they're able to bring that in effectively, Europe will probably continue to progress at a really rapid pace. That's a question right now because of cost of living, and we're seeing some of the member countries kind of push back on it. But I think we're probably at a little bit of a testing point there. Another kind of interesting aspect as well is probably the US-EU negotiations around tariffs are going to matter to how this plays out. And you might know that Europe has this carbon border adjustment mechanism, which is called CBAM, which is basically meant to kind of equalize pricing and protect its domestic industry, but by applying carbon taxes. So this is seen as probably one of the levers that Europe might have at its disposal when it negotiates with the U.S. So I think looking at that decarbonization pathway is, it's probably going to, all these factors are going to play into how rapidly or not rapidly things change across Europe.
Well, thank you, Maria. This has been, you know, a really wide-ranging discussion. I appreciate you taking the time and lending, you know, your expertise across this topic.
Thanks, Jackie. It was a great discussion.
We've talked about how kind of different countries compare through the energy trilemma lens. And, you know, despite perhaps some of the kind of negative narrative that we've heard in the market, you know, really, in some regions, green technologies are no longer seen as a trade-off with affordability, but actually they go hand in hand. And I think the energy transition, you know, has structural tailwinds behind it. Thank you again for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find out more information on this and other topics on our website. And please take the time to rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle, better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in November of 2025 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside of the United States, it is for investment professional use only and is not intended to be used by persons and jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. This podcast does not give advice or recommendations of any nature or constitute an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a guarantee or a reliable indicator of future results. All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. Discussions relating to specific securities are informational only and are not recommendations and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. There should be no assumptions that the securities will or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with any companies discussed. The views contained herein are those of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. These views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed. The source for the statement about Europe having reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by 37% is the European Commission's EU Climate Action Progress Report of 2025. The source for the statement about 47% of the European Union's electricity supply coming from renewables is from an EU Eurostat article titled "Electricity from Renewable Sources Reaches 47% in 2024" and published March 19, 2025. The source for the statement about 24% of the European Union's electricity supply coming from nuclear is from Ember's European Union page, last updated November 2025. 2025, please visit http://www.troprice.com/theanglepodcast for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price 2026.